Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. On the 26th of May in 1896, a gentleman by the name of Charles Dow would look at the share prices of just 12 companies, add them together, and divide by 12. The result was 40.94. That was known as the first Dow Jones Industrial Average. Fast forward today, it is one of the three leading indices in the US as a performance indicator. It does measure more than 12 companies today. And it certainly does provide a lot more color around how it is that markets are assessed. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest developments at South African Airways, the chief executive officer currently acting in that position, placed on special leave. We try and make sense of that with our aviation expert, Guy Leach. We also take a look at the developments at the SPAR Group, confirming that the chair and deputy chair of that board both having resigned effective from today. We're going to take a look at that and see what those potential governance concerns could mean for that business. Then we also have a conversation with the team at 91, taking a look at the South African bond market and how it is that investors have been looking at that landscape. And we have a conversation with Merchant West, taking a look at artificial intelligence winners and losers in the market. While we're looking at artificial intelligence, we're going to take a look from a personal finance standpoint on the role that you should be assigning to artificial intelligence in your investment making decisions.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
That's where we kick off the show, as always, with a sense of market movements that have been happening throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by senior markets analyst at Rand Swiss, Sean Murison, to take a look at markets and see if we can make sense of them. Sean, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. The Rand performing a lot better than what it has of late, but to be fair to the Rand, it has been holding its ground against predominantly the US dollar amidst all of these uncertain times we find ourselves in global markets. What do you make of the Rand coming back sub 1620, looking like it could seemingly hold there and potentially, if I'm being a little optimistic, retest 16 Rand?
Yeah, the Rand's looking good at the moment, Jimmy. If you take that chart and you zoom out a little bit of the dollar versus the Rand, you can see it's just moving from the top left-hand side of your page to the bottom right-hand side. So there's actually a trend of strength. In the short term, a little bit different. It's been range-bound. Now we're testing the bottom end of that range. So a lot of the movement in the short term, obviously, weakness of the dollar. And the dollar, you know, it's all around the Fed and what to expect from the Fed. You know, a little while ago, we were all looking at, you know, possibility of the Fed starting to hike rates, possibly in September at their meeting, and then a slew of not so good data, surprisingly lower inflation data than expected, and now, you know, there's a chance that the Fed might not raise rates. So, the resulting effect, weaker dollar, and we're a short-term beneficiary thereof.
Sean, speaking of things that we're a beneficiary of, I want to take a look at the gold price, $4,420 of fine ounce at the moment. If I'm looking at the kind of the monthly chart on that, $4,000 of fine ounce was the best support level we could have seen. Our gold mining stocks have reported numbers last week was DRD Gold. They're benefiting from the more than double gold price that we saw compared to, I want to say, this time last year or so. Markets finally showing gold some love amidst all of these tensions. We saw it struggle a bit since it came off of those $5,000 fine ounce highs, but it looks like we might be going back to retest those.
Well, I hope so. And you can see our local market, our top 40 index is following. You know, the chart is not that dissimilar to gold, and obviously a lot of gold shares are heavily weighted in the index, the likes of Goldfields in particular being at 7% weighting on that index. But when you look at the gold price in particular, it's been, you know, it had a very strong start to the year. We've corrected, and then we've just sort of done nothing for a while. And now it looks like it's starting to get a leg up. And there's definitely, you know, you can see it's a very sort of inverse correlation to what we're seeing with the dollar. Everything, you know, just seems to always trace back to the dollar. But as we see that dollar weakening, we're seeing all metal prices, precious metal prices up. So gold is looking good at the moment. It's actually up about 1% today, last I checked, over that $4,400 per ounce mark. Silver's up. It's looking good. But we're still a far cry from what we saw earlier in the year. I think we're at about $5,600. So, but short term, yeah, definitely looking a lot more bullish.
Sean, let's stay with those precious metals for a moment. I want to look at PGMs. Platinum in particular, we're flirting with that $1,800 fine ounce level. $1,850 was kind of the highs that we got to earlier in the year. It would be nice to go back there, particularly because there was a period of time, much like where you said gold was moving sideways, platinum was highly unloved. The PGM counters just kind of struggled through, and we're finally seeing, I suppose, with all of momentum returning very slowly to the markets, that the likes of platinum are set to continue going up, even with an oil price dangerously close to $90 a barrel.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you start looking at PGMs, there's also, obviously platinum, we're the major producer of platinum, so it's nice to see, you know, a rebound in that. A lot of different demand side factors, you know, it has an industrial use, not just a precious metal, obviously a jewelry use. I remember the days many years ago that, platinum used to trade ahead of gold. Not the case right now. There's a lot to platinum, I think, in the short term. So I'm a bit more bullish on gold than I am on platinum. You know, reliance on PGMs when you start moving towards an EV world becomes less. Obviously, platinum, you know, in catalytic converters. So, yeah, I think platinum looking good short term. I think longer term, we still prefer gold.
Sean, can we take a look at the oil price? $87.50 a barrel or so, $90 at the moment, starting to feel like a very comfortable spot for the oil price. Not necessarily where we want to see it, but with the fact that we've had the word ceasefire thrown around so many times and yet we're still at a war, I suppose the market is very hesitant to be believing that the war is over there by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, a lot has happened today. It's the end of that 60-day ceasefire between US and Iran. Not that it seems to have made much of a difference. We've had Trump obviously threatening Oman now, and they're a mediator. It's just saying don't get in the way of their blockades. And then we have some frail ties there between a frail ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. So there's a lot of catalysts for oil at this point in time. But I'd say it hasn't blown out. It hasn't gone back to the levels we saw earlier on. So markets have started to digest it. Routes for oil have, you know, markets have found a different way. We still are reliant on that Strait of Hormuz. But I think, I don't know if we're going to get back to those lower levels that we saw pre-war, the $60 per barrel mark. I think markets are at 87.90 seems to be a new norm for now. And, we don't know when this war is going to end. And at the moment, it doesn't look like there's really any progress going forward. So I think we can expect oil to stay a little bit higher for longer, although I would hope not to see it back above that $100 per barrel mark.
Sean, can we take a look at local markets? You touched on the fact that we are benefiting from being a platinum-producing nation and gold-producing nation, but aside from the 3% gains we saw in resource stocks today, other sectors, financial stocks were down, industrials were down. The top 40 still managed to eke out almost 0.7% gains. Yes, resources played a big part of that, but overall, we've had a strong showing for this year on the JSE.
Yeah, I think everybody's had a turn at lifting the index over the last year or two. Last year, it was the year of gold and platinum and the resources. And then this year, you know, our financials have done quite well, propping up the market. So I've actually lost sight of the question there, Jimmy.
Just a sense of the markets, the JSE in particular, Sean. I mean, it's above 114,000 points in the case of the all share, almost 107,000 points in the case of the top 40. Amidst all of the uncertainty around the world, we've seen markets, especially emerging markets, kind of take a bit of a knock or a bit of a dip. Our JSE has really strengthened throughout the year.
Yeah, I think our market is still a little bit undervalued when you put it into context of like global markets. You know, I think if you We know the excitement around growth and AI in tech, which has been pushing US markets and that. But, you know, valuations, I mean, just on a price earnings point of view, I think S&P is sitting probably about a PE of about 27. And then when you start looking at our companies, which, and a lot of them have solid balance sheets, good companies, consistent yield, I think our market's one of the second cheapest outside of Philippines. I think it's sitting on a PE of just over 9, 10, somewhere around about there. So there is still some value, and it is showing some resilience in a volatile marketplace. I mean, we've had a lot to contend with between, you know, social media seems to be, you know, driving force of markets, and we've had wars and uncertainty around monetary policy, you know, in the US and trickling down to us. So, yeah, good work, JSE.
The JSE doing its bit amidst all of the global uncertainty, and the Rand also holding strong, currently at 16.17 against the US dollar, about 15 basis points stronger on the day's trade. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Senior markets analyst at Rand Swiss, Sean Murison, joining us to take a look at markets and make sense of them.
Hi, I need irrigation funding for my farm.
Something that tracks moisture across the farm and rotates your crops?
Well,
Plus sensors that read your soil, reduce waste, and send water exactly where it's needed.
I was thinking basic irrigation, but financing
for a smart farming system
is actually what I need.
At NetBank, we see more. From regenerative agriculture to smart farming solutions, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think NetBank Commercial Banking. See money differently. NetBank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know, soil health is about more than nutrients? It's also about the physical, biological, and chemical properties that determine what's happening below the surface. With Omnia's Nutriology model, producers get a clear picture of their soil, so every recommendation starts with better insight. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
With a complete view of your finances, NetBank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, NetBank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. NetBank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This morning we got the announcements that the SPAR Group's chairperson and deputy chair have both tendered their resignations. We're going to be taking a look at this in greater detail with senior investment analyst at Anchor Capital, Stefan Erasmus. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Stefan, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Very interesting timing of these two resignations following the abrupt exit of the SPAR chief executive officer a little while ago. What do you make of these latest announcements?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, keeping us on our toes at SPAR, it seems. I think the moves are probably a step in the right direction. If you just consider the corporate governance concerns, or at least issues that have been raised over the last couple of years, yeah, the body representing the largest SPAR retailers called for the resignation of the chairperson in May, I believe. And so this has kind of been hanging over the board for a while. And I think, you know, the results of SPAR in the first half added more pressure. And as you rightly pointed to, the CEO also kind of wasn't expected, his resignation wasn't expected. So you put all of that together and you have a balance sheet that's under pressure, and these kind of abrupt changes do happen.
Stefan, can we take a look at perhaps SPAR in relation to some of the other retailers in South Africa? We know that Pick and Pay has been going through its own challenges. SPAR, as of the recent set of numbers in the previous reporting period, they've confirmed that they've exited markets like Poland. They've downsized their focus to come back to focusing on the South African market in greater detail. Let's just look at the retail landscape, particularly where it relates to the grocery retailers in South Africa. Some are struggling, some are trying to navigate difficult internal problems, and some, like the ShopRite group that gave us a trading statement just last week don't seem to have any of these problems.
Yeah, it's quite a variety of sort of situations you've got in terms of the investment cases. I suppose I'll start with the ones that I prefer most. I would say ShopRite, really a case of, I think, taking market share at the expense of the likes of Pick n Pay and Spar. So where they've been tripping up, ShopRite has been expanding at quite a rapid rate and taking up market share. I mean, I was having a look at 60/60's numbers. Their revenue number is $25 billion. That's half of Woolworths Foods revenue. So it's becoming quite a juggernaut in its own right. And then you've got Boxer, which also, again, has been doing quite nicely, you know, really priced for that lower LSM market, but expanding nicely into white space opportunity. And then, yeah, you've got the, I suppose, the two kind of sort of entities that have had their kind of well-publicized problems in Spar and Pick n Pay. The Spar group, unfortunately, I mean, today's events won't do anything to sort of settle the investment case, I don't think. But like I said, you know, I think it is a step in the right direction in terms of starting fresh with hopefully a chairperson that can get on, or at least that that the retailers sort of are happy with, and that'll help the Spar investment case. And then Pick n Pay, yeah, they've unfortunately deferred their break even guidance twice now. I think it's FY 2029 now, and they're busy going through a Section 189 labor process, which is not ideal for the group. But without that cost base restructured, it's very difficult to see Pick n Pay get back to break even. So very high level, that's sort of my analysis of the different investment cases.
Stefan, you mentioned that these resignations could potentially be beneficial for the Spar group. I want to take a look at how it is that a group like Spar then restructures from a governance point of view. We've touched on the exits that you've seen. We've touched on the other challenges that the Spar group has faced in the past. How then does a restructuring at this point look, or how should it then look if we are to restore investor confidence in the investment case that is there for the Spar group?
I think what it comes down to is it comes down to performance. I mean, at the end of the day, Spar is a wholesaler that supplies independent retailers. And as we've seen, the Spar numbers have not been great. And by definition, the retailers' numbers haven't been great. So if you can kind of reset the relationship between the wholesaler and the retailers, and you get a chairperson who the retailers are happy with, et cetera, that immediately changes that relationship. So I think it's kind of starting with a clean slate. But again, it's key that the retailers are happy with that appointment. And I think it's also quite telling that in the announcement, the board made mention of the fact that they are looking for a skill set of extensive retail experience as well as independent retail experience. So in a way, kind of, you know, saying, okay, we definitely need more of that kind of skill on our board. So I think the takeaway really for me is, you know, it's kind of an opportunity to reset the relationship and try and get, you know, into a sort of scenario where both parties are winning, because ultimately they do depend on each other. If one does well, the other one does well. So it is in their interest to sort it out, I suppose.
Sudden resignations at the Spar group potentially providing an opportunity to reset relationships between the group and its retail network. We'll have to see if that reset does indeed take place and how it is that the Spar group moves forward from this point on. For now, there is interim leadership in place to continue with the business's day-to-day operations. There's an interim chair who has over 7 years on the Spar board, so the business does still have a leadership in various respects. We'll see how this develops from this point forward. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Stefan Erasmus, Senior Investment Analyst at Anchor Capital, joining us to take a look at the resignations at the Spar Group and how they could potentially affect the retailer.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Moving away from resignations to suspensions, we got confirmation on Friday that the acting group chief executive officer at South African Airways has been placed on special leave with immediate effect, pending the outcome of an internal process. We're going to be taking a look at this with our aviation expert, Dr. Guy Leach, who joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Guy, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. We were surprised when we got the sudden resignation of the previous CEO along with the three board members that left at the same time. We got the announcement that we've got an interim acting chief executive officer. Now there's a suspension there. What do we make of these developments?
Yeah, hi, Jimmy, and nice to be with you as always. Well, I think that clearly what we are to make of it is that it points to a much deeper malaise or problem within SAA. The reality is that the airline is really battling. It's put on a very brave face since the business rescue process and COVID, but that face started showing big cracks when the annual financial results were examined, and we suddenly saw that what looked very suspiciously like a couple of billion-dollar bailouts and selling off the family silver in terms of London Heathrow slots to try and keep the airline solvent or at least cash positive. So there was enormous pressure on Prof. John Lamola, and there was a lot of questions asked when he suddenly bailed with three board members. And of course, let's not forget that the Auditor General was extremely critical of not just qualifying the results, but disclaiming the financial results. So it showed that the airline was in a pretty poor condition. And of course, the CFO went at the same time as well. So the acting CEO job for Mr. Shishebi must have been a temporary job and a hospital pass. I see that there is reports in the daily newspapers today saying everyone saying, oh, I told you so. Well, in a sense, I suppose it's easy to say that, because they really do need to find the right person for the job. And it is an impossibly difficult job to actually do properly.
Guy, what seems to be the difficulty around the job? I mean, you touched on the fact that we did start to see some signs of life when we looked at the financials until we dug a little deeper. I remember having a conversation with the then chief executive at the time, Prof. Lamola, around whether or not SAA intended to go back to being the largest airline on the African continent as it once was, whether they were looking at expanding routes, expanding into more global operations. And the firm answer at the time, if I remember correctly, the firm answer was no, we're going to focus on the operations we have at the moment, making sure that those work. So then I suppose the question then here is, which direction does SAA need to be moving in?
Okay, the answer is, Prof. Lamola was correct. The airline cannot aspire to be the biggest airline on the African continent again, because Ethiopian airline has shot ahead to an uncatchable position, and quite frankly all the other long-haul carriers, all the external international long-haul carriers, have come in and eaten SAA's lunch on the long-haul routes, especially those operating through the Middle East hubs, Emirates in particular. So SAA had reset its sights to becoming just a regional carrier. Also, it needs to be noted, by the way, that the airline is so undercapitalized that it can't possibly afford to buy new aircraft, even lease them at competitive rates. So it's making do with old aircraft and trying to operate on regional routes. That means with domestic routes in South Africa and across Southern Africa up to Accra and Ghana. But it's really batting on those routes as well. While there's been quite decent growth, the airline has found itself very short of equipment. And indeed, the airline industry around the world it's got 6 to 7 year waiting lists for new aircraft. So SAA is not going to get out of that hole very quickly. The reality is that it looks like it's back to the bad old days before Dudu Mienyi, where the airline just cannot fulfill its mandate of being both a developmental institution and a competitive airline without at least costing the taxpayer R1 billion a year or more.
Guy, with that in mind, where then does the intervention sit from the taxpayer's perspective? In this case, unlike other businesses, the stakeholder in question here is the government of South Africa, and by extension, the people of South Africa. Minister Creasy, as I suppose the representative stakeholder for this particular asset or this particular SOE, if you are then sitting in her shoes, perhaps, and you're looking at this SOE and saying, we need to figure out what we're doing here, what decision needs to be taken here from a stakeholder perspective around how we move SAA forward?
Well, the big question, which no one actually wants to address, dare I call it the elephant in the room, is do we need a state-owned airline at all? The answer, actually, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, is no. these days in codeship operations, you can often buy a ticket and you end up flying on a completely different airline. And indeed, that was Lamola's and Shashevi's strategy. They were going to continue to expand the codeshare operations in the absence of being able to buy new aircraft. So there's not a lot of argument to be made that we continue to need a flag carrier. I'm reasonably open to the argument that the airline is important and plays a useful role in terms of the multiplier effect it brings in creating transport linkages. That's very much my field of study, and I'm sympathetic to that. But there are limits to how much you can afford to do that, because what really needs to not be forgotten is that subsidizing an airline means that you are effectively taking funds from the poor to subsidize the rich travelers. And I think that in many senses in a development economy such as South Africa is unconscionable. So the airline solemnly promised, or rather Pravin Gordhan solemnly promised, that it wouldn't ask for bailouts. I don't know how much longer that promise is going to last.
Guy, about 2 weeks ago, the UAE-based airline Emirates Airline agreed to increase the number of regional codes and access codes with South African Airways. Some strategic decisions that were made there around kind of expanding the relationship between the two commercial airlines. Is that sort of agreement a potential solution to SAA's current woes, or does that create new sets of problems for the airline and not address the underlying existing problems?
No, it's very much the correct strategy, probably the only really real strategy to go right now. And the great pity about it is that we shouldn't be messing around with interlining agreements and code share agreements at this stage, because under Nico Bezuidenhout 10 years ago, an actual partnership, pretty much a strategic equity partnership, was negotiated and signed with, or rather agreed with Emirates, and it was all due to be signed at the Paris Air Show, when Dudu Mieni phoned up Nico Bezuidenhout and said he couldn't come back to South Africa if he signed it. And that really, really set the airline back enormously, because it would have been great for it to have had a true partner like Emirates. So at this stage, I won't say it's right reorganizing the deck chairs on the Titanic to mess around with codeshare agreements. It all helps. But it's not the silver bullet that will help SAA become profitable again. The real issue about these codeshares is what we call feeding and defeeding of routes. You know, you need to be able to defeed your routes by getting the people off the aircraft and then onto regional airlines to take them to, you know, Vergenoeg and Blix on the Water and all of those sort of places. And you need to feed your routes by getting other airlines to bring people to use your routes so you can book through with one place. That's what these code-sharing agreements do. So it all helps, but it's not a solution in itself.
The national carrier known as South African Airways facing some serious questions following the special leave of the acting chief executive officer and where the airline heads to from here. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Aviation expert Dr. Guy Leach joining us to take a look at these developments and see if we can make sense of them.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
This investment feature is brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change. Speak to your financial advisor or visit 91.com to invest in your financial future. With the growing volatility around the world, markets are often looking for a good indicator of whether or not some economies are performing better than expected. We're going to be taking a look at South Africa's key indicators in our own bond market in a bit more detail with the head of SA Fixed Income at 91, Mokgatla Madisha. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Dr. Madisha, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start with the conversations that have been coming out of National Treasury most recently. Director Director General Duncan Peters at Treasury noted that South Africa's bond market effectively gave an indication to the market that South Africa had been upgraded even before ratings agencies like Fitch and Moody's confirmed that. What do you think led to those statements by the DG?
Yeah, no, South African bond market have performed very, very well over the last 2 years. And even beginning of this year, we saw them continue to outperform. I think there are a number of things one can look at. For sure, when the DG spoke last week, he was referring to the credit spread of South Africa's dollar bonds over the US bonds. But there have been a number of other indications that show that the bond market is effectively giving SA a ratings upgrade. You know, one need only look at the steepness of the curve. By that, I mean the spread between the longer dated bonds and the shorter maturities, which has, you know, come from very high levels at the beginning of last year, with a 30-year and less the 5-year coming in from about 285 basis points, currently closer to 100 basis points, for example. You know, those are the kind of indicators that show that, you know, investors have become a lot more confident about South Africa's fiscal outlook.
Mohatla, speaking of that fiscal outlook, just today, National Treasury confirmed, of course, the official dates for the tabling of the midterm budget policy statement. And alongside that, we are expecting that an update on our fiscal strategy will be provided there. If we are to look ahead to an event like that, it's set to take place in October, and we're a bit further out from that. What has been actually driving our fiscal improvement up to this point in time? We know commodities have had a good run. We know that structurally, though, South Africa has been looking better. The rand has performed better as well. It's held its own against some of the major currencies. What's been driving the big fiscal improvements that we've been seeing?
Well, even before the MTBPS on the 21st of October, as you indicated, we're going to be looking forward to Q2 GDP numbers. With that, we expect a rebasing exercise to be announced, or the result of the rebasing exercise. Up to now, what we've seen is PIT, or personal income tax, running quite far ahead of budgeted numbers. And also, as you point out, you know, on the company side, company tax has been buoyed by strong commodity prices as well. But one need also look at VAT, which is running ahead of expectations. So there's a number of questions that need to be answered. You know, where is this performance coming from?
Mohatla, speaking of questions that need to be answered, when I think about the ratings agencies that we mentioned earlier, the likes Moody's, S&P, Fitch, they're almost lagging behind in how it is that they report on information and data. And I suppose to a certain extent that can be to our favor, to our benefit. If we think about the fact that some of their ratings decisions come after some improvements and not necessarily in anticipation of things that may or may not pan out. All of the ratings agencies have expressed kind of a common consensus that they are viewing South Africa as stable at the moment, but they haven't yet upgraded our outlook and upgraded us fully to at least even returning back to investment grade. What's it going to take for us, from a fiscal perspective, to start to perhaps sway their minds in that direction?
I mean, I would say, you know, when S&P was the first out, you know, out the blocks in November last year, upgrading South Africa's rating from a double B minus to a double B flat. But they also upgraded us to a positive outlook. And we've since seen Moody's and Fitch follow suit. So in that respect, initially they weren't behind the curve, as we would say. But, you know, where we are now, given where the market is definitely priced in South Africa as if it is already double B plus type level. From here onwards, I think we need sustained strong growth. I think National Treasury has shown its commitment to fiscal sustainability by, you know, penciling in primary surpluses. That's and now we have a history of that, so that's good. But from here, we need growth to be stronger. We need particularly also need debt levels to be substantially lower than where they are. If you look at triple B minor or triple B rating countries in general have debt to GDPs closer to the 55%. South Africa sitting at a debt ratio of about 78%, we're still quite a long way away from where the median investment grade country is. That's not to say that we have to get to that level to get a rating upgrade into investment grade, but certainly we would have to be, you know, substantially closer to that sort of level, and the trajectory on growth would have to be significantly stronger than current.
Mokgatla, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the recent decisions by the Monetary Policy Committee of the Central Bank of South Africa. We know that interest rates form a critical part of the bond market and the fixed income landscape. And I want to take a look at the most recent interest rate decisions. In May, we got the first rate hike after quite a considerable period of time. In July, we got a surprise rate hold where we thought we would get another hike. What do these decisions mean for the bond market, and how does the bond market typically interpret or anticipate that these decisions will impact investment flows?
Well, yeah, if you look at the decision in June, July, it was a surprise, as you point out. However, you know, we must understand that the backdrop is very, very uncertain. And, you know, while we have sort of changing our minds every day, you know, the SARB doesn't. Since the May action, they had seen the memorandum of understanding between the US and Iran signed, that led to almost a collapse of oil prices. So, you know, the inflation outlook was looking significantly better. But just before the July MPC, you know, it looked like, you know, hostilities were rearing their ugly heads again. So, you know, the environment continues to be one of great volatility. And in actual fact, you know, there's very little that monetary policy can do about the immediate outlook for inflation. However, when you sort of take a slightly longer term view, that being sort of 12 to 18 months over which monetary policy is effective, you will notice that, you know, even at the current level of a repo rate and projected inflation, real interest rates are not that negative, actually, and are quite consistent with bringing inflation down more gradually in the medium term. So, yeah, I think initial disappointment, but the backdrop is highly uncertain. You know, right now we've seen sort of oil come back from that 90 level towards sort of 80 and now back again. So in the medium term, I think the market will give them some grace.
In uncertain times, bond markets can often provide investors with some very useful insights as to where investor sentiment might be sitting around a particular economy. South Africa certainly is a testament to that. For now, we'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Head of SA Fixed Income at 91, Mokgatla Madisha, joining us to take a look at recent decisions in the market and how they could have potentially affected the bond market. This feature was brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change. Speak to your financial advisor or visit 91.com to invest in your financial future.
35 years ago, we started asking a simple question. What if change wasn't something to survive, but something to invest in? Markets have risen and fallen. Technology has rewritten the rules. The world has shifted in ways nobody predicted. Through it all, we kept investing with conviction for the long term for you. Change is opportunity. We're always ready to invest in it. 91. Investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
The world of artificial intelligence has seen many winners and losers, and the team at Merchant West have been keeping an eye on these. The conversation you're about to listen to was had with my colleague Dudu Zile Ramela. While I was away, the team at Merchant West had some important thoughts to share around the biggest winners and losers in the world of AI.
Merchants by trade, explorers at heart. Go beyond with Merchant West. The global economy is facing challenges but has fared much better than anticipated in the face of one shock after another. Capital markets are seeing accelerated momentum, more so in global markets where there is an exponential AI capex boom and all-time returns in other sectors. The speed and momentum is reshaping how equity markets move, with assets showing an increased rate of price change over time. Neil Wegwerf is an equity analyst with Merchant West Investments. He joins us now to see how we can find quality companies in a momentum-driven world. Thank you very much for your time this evening. How are you advising your clients, at least, on understanding and managing the momentum investing?
Yeah, so we view it from a different lens. So to separate the words momentum and quality, momentum definitely tells you what's currently popular within the market environment at the moment, but quality actually tells you what's durable. And those are two fundamentally different questions. And from our side, we believe that the market keeps actually confusing those two.
So you contend that the crowd pays for what's moving this quarter and underappreciates businesses that compound quietly for a decade. Can you expand on that for us?
Yeah, so from our perspective, we believe that the market is actually very good at pricing in the next quarter and adjusting to the estimates from analysts when companies do actually release quarterly results. But we believe that where quality is the differentiator is that they're actually terrible at pricing the next decade. So we believe that gap to be the opportunity.
The hot topic right now, of course, artificial intelligence. When you look at the capex boom right now, there's going to be a lot of winners and losers. How do you see separation, right, where you're separating the AI losers and winners?
Yeah, so it's very important to put those into various different buckets. So we currently contend with three different buckets at the moment. So we've got the AI losers, the AI winners, and then there's just that too hard pile where the mental return on effort is quite difficult to actually get a fundamental answer about where the winners and losers could actually fit in.
Help us understand the AI supply chain if we take a step back.
Yeah, so we've seen the hyperscalers come out with these extraordinary large amounts of money that they are being spent across all the data centers in the US. So these are impacting a lot of different companies at the moment, such as the equipment manufacturers. And then you can think of the likes of the fabs, so TSMC as well as ASML. And that's where we currently are finding the opportunities in the quality buckets in the AI supply chain.
So if you can expand on that, please, for us, because finding quality companies in this world driven by momentum can sometimes be tricky.
Yeah, and that's fully agree with you. Define a quality company is that where if you gave it another rand or dollar for that matter to invest, it earns far more than a cost to actually raise that rand. And it's really the durability of that which matters. And if they can do that for an extended period of time, you'll really start to see that coming through in the durability of the moat of the business, as well as the return on capital that the business is able to produce through the cycle.
What do you say to those who predict the market, if you will, or predict the next move on the market? What's the advice there? Is that a prudent move?
No, I would strongly against that. Forecasts are exactly that. They're a forecast. And market commentators love to just create noise around different figures and forecasts within the market. So we prefer to sort of separate the numbers from the narrative, and that ultimately plays into the strength in quality investing.
So Neil, a good story at any price is not an investment. Is it a subscription in other people's optimism?
No, exactly. And that's just how we view it. Ultimately, we bottom-up fundamental investors. So the price we pay for an asset has to matter down the line, because you're ultimately getting entitled to that stream of cash flows. So we're very sensitive to when momentum dominates the market, as well as just trying to read through the actual storylines and feel like if it's actually impacting the underlying fundamental qualities of the business, and if that intrinsic value is ultimately compounding over time.
Neil Wegwerf is an equity analyst with Merchant West Investments. Thank you very much, Neil. Brought to you by Merchant West, where ambition becomes reality. If you're still paying rent on your business premises, you're investing in your landlord, not your business. Merchant West offers commercial property finance with up to 100% loan to value. So instead of paying rent, you're building equity in your own asset. For fast approvals and specialists who understand your business, go beyond. Visit merchantwest.co.za.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is personal finance time on a Monday. We're going to be taking a look at the role that artificial intelligence can and potentially should be playing in your investment decisions. I'm joined on the line by financial planner at NMG Benefits, Stian de Wit, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Stian, lovely having you back on the show. It's been a while. It certainly has. A lot has happened since you and I have last spoken. We're now using things like artificial intelligence to decide whether or not we should buy portfolio assets. AI can be a good thing in the world of investing, but it can also be dangerous.
Yes, good evening, Jimmy. Yeah, we see that a lot of times. Currently, the challenge we have is that AI is democratizing financial information, but information isn't always advice. And with advice, there's stuff like behavior, human behavior, and things like that. And Evelyn, as we speak and talking about AI.
Stian, what parts of artificial intelligence are useful to consider when thinking about investment decisions? I mean, what comes to mind for me, at least, is the aggregation of information. If I've got so much information out there in the technological day and age we live in, AI could be quite useful to kind of consolidate all of that information. But how do you see the role of AI as a useful tool here?
I think it's brilliant for the average investor out there to start using AI when they talk even to a financial planner to analyze that information and ask questions on what are the relevance to my situation. And things like looking at your fund fact sheets, it might give you a fund fact sheet, might analyze the cost of an investment. Stuff like that is very important. And I think AI makes life a lot easier for the average guy out there that is not a sophisticated investor to almost dumb it down so that him or she can actually understand that information.
Stian, when then does it become dangerous to look at AI? If we are able to use it to look at information, if we're able to kind of use it as an analysis tool, where then does the slippery slope start?
Jimmy, one of the first things to keep in mind, if you use AI, never, never, ever give your personal information to an AI, a chatbot, or even especially if it's a free version, because that information becomes public domain. And your personal information you are throwing out there, it's like someone phoning you randomly and you giving them your ID number or your pay slip or stuff like that. You won't do it. So number one, do not throw personal information down the AI rabbit hole, if I can call it that. I think the second thing, and this is where we did a brilliant study where they and behavioral tax, because behavioral tax is a massive challenge for financial individuals, where 4.2% of analyzed returns are eroded because someone, it's not very stir. That's a lot of times the problems. Like when the market crash, people become irrational and they make irrational decisions. And AI will probably not be your sounding board in that situation and be the financial planner that tell you, listen, this is what happens in the market. Stay invested where you're at. So in that emotion, AI won't be able to help you there.
Stian, let's take a look at the role of a financial advisor. That role has been changing since it was created, and it will continue to change as people have different financial needs. How then does the current role of a financial advisor fit into the portfolio composition, the investment decisions, and all the other aspects of making critical investment decisions? And can that role be enhanced through the use of something like artificial intelligence?
Absolutely. Most financial planners that we're dealing with on a daily basis, we actually had a session with the FPI last week around this, where they are also using AI, but it's used not to dismiss the human element, the human touch, but actually to enhance efficiency, create effectiveness, so that those financial planners can actually spend more time with their clients, because that's where the real value is. You know, if you go to AI and ask AI, listen, give me advice on what I want to invest 5,000 Rand. AI won't know the context. You know, it's like building a house. If you just put it how I design my house, it won't know where the beams should be, where's the water lines and stuff like that. So financial planners ask the right questions. A proper financial planner will ask you context, will understand your emotions, will understand your family context, will understand your tax. There are so many things. And the challenge with AI is a lot of times in the prompt that we have a very limited way in which we communicate, and it will only give you back on what you ask it.
Stian, what shouldn't you be asking AI around personal financial advice or in obtaining financial advice? You touched on the fact that sharing of personal information is quite a dangerous place to be where it relates to AI. What other areas potentially pose a dangerous threat, especially where it relates to financial decisions that individuals might be looking to make with the help of AI?
That's a very difficult question to answer because it depends on the context that you're in. So I think the thing that's important on not asking the content questions that will potentially, you know, it's great getting advice, but I would take that advice and talk to someone about that on AI because what AI says about that specific topic. So for instance, if you say, okay, I want to invest money into retirement, or should I invest money into retirement annuity? Ask those questions, but then take those questions to a financial planner. And again, don't give your personal information out there, but and don't take what AI says as the truth, because it can hallucinate, and we've seen how it hallucinates when it goes down the wrong rabbit hole.
Mm. Stian, where it relates to those questions that are being asked, I mean, for a lot of people, the question comes up around the costs. I can pay for an AI subscription. It might be cheaper than paying for a financial advisor. It might return to me the same general information that I would from a research perspective. And I suppose this is where people then say, okay, but then how do I justify the cost of a financial planner? Now, you and I have spoken about this particular point in other conversations to say that it's better to find out the costs up front than to find out how much you've lost many, many years later. But as a parting thought, I want to get your thoughts around how then financial planners that are using AI then start to perhaps factor that into their costs, or perhaps we start to split costs as consumers and say, I'll pay for a certain portion of a particular service. Does this introduction of artificial intelligence have the potential to impact how we cost financial advisory?
Great question. We've never had more financial information available to us as of to date. Yet, in the South African context, just on the life insurance side, we have a 50 trillion rand protection gap. That is 6.5 times more than South African GDP. That tells me information isn't alone isn't the answer. You know, so there's a massive difference between knowing the information and actually doing something about it. And then if you look at the behavioral, I spoke about briefly about what Momentum did, that number of behavioral tax, to give you, I did a quick analysis on that. If you take a 1 million rand investment and you say, okay, over a 10-year period, if I had to go and say, I invest that money, but I manage it myself and I look at the statistics that talks about the behavioral tax, that difference is between 3 million, it's a 3 million rand over after 10 years versus a 6 million rand after 10 years. So 4.2% sounds like a minor number, but the value of advisor is sticking with you and growing with you as an individual and guiding you through the process and helping you make those right decisions. That's the value advice. It's not just the investment, but it's things like tax. A good example, if a proper financial planner sit with an individual and they look at their retirement planning, you can reduce your tax by 20% in retirement. That is a 5 to 7 years extension on your in-retirement income. That's the value of a financial planner.
Financial planners, financial advisors, they do still hold value and they're not about to be replaced by the use of artificial intelligence. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Financial planner at NMG Benefits, Stian de Wit, joining us to take a look at the role of artificial intelligence in financial advisory.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Just like that, folks, that's the end of the show. That's the update for today. If you've missed any of the conversations, they will be made available as podcasts for you to catch up on. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hoss and the SAFM News team are going to be standing by with the latest round of evening news. They will, of course, be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. It also means from my side, good night.